For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am very, very pleased to be able to sit across the table once again, one last time in 2021, with Dr. Art Sear Clawson, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, author of After the Cold War, and a syndicated columnist whose work appears in newspapers across the country. And he's also a frequent visitor to WUWM, and I'm happy to say a monthly visitor to the morning show. And on this visit in the middle of December, as the school year approaches its end, I should say the semester approaches its end, there is a whole lot to talk about, as usual. And I'm really glad that we have Art Sear to engage in a conversation about the really pressing and important matters related to the domestic and foreign front. Dr. Art Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'd show up for the gracious introduction all by itself. It's always a tonic. Thank you.
That made it. That makes the drive worth it. I'm glad you had a nice sunny day to drive. So, how does the end of the semester feel for you?
Good, students. It's a very sociable time in life, as I vaguely remember from my own undergraduate days a long, long time ago. And I've been teaching in person as much as possible, and we are pretty much back in person, I'm glad to say. So I'm feeling up about that.
Yeah, that feels good.
We haven't had a nuclear war, and other things that could have gone wrong have not gone wrong. So that's one way to look at life, right?
Very good. Yeah, lots to be thankful for, that's for sure. Actually, one of the things I wanted to talk about first with you is this thing called inflation that we are dealing with right now here in the United States, and inflation numbers that I understand are the highest since the Reagan administration.
Yeah.
And you know a whole lot about economics than I do, so maybe you could just give us a little crash course or refresher course or whatever you want to call it. On what inflation is, and maybe even a little, some words of wisdom on where it comes from and why we are seeing the kind of inflation that we are right now.
Inflation is rising prices, and we're seeing signs of that now, and it shouldn't be surprising because the U.S. government has been engaging in, including our central bank, has been engaging in huge amounts of spending. Not only very, very large fiscal deficits in historical terms, not just the literal amount, but related to our tax income and the size of the gross domestic product, and also our central bank has been releasing a lot of money into the system. And that when you have a lot of money chasing goods and services, that raises prices. I've been a little surprised that the lag has been as great as it has been. I think it's a sign of our prosperity globally and the fact that we're in a global economy. Other economically advanced nations have been pursuing similar policies so that we've been seeing an awful lot of money in the system. I hope that's clear. You looked a little puzzled.
Well, I remain a little puzzled, but I'll get clarification in a second. So what you're saying, I think, is that you would have expected us to see higher inflation sooner than this. You're surprised that it's taken this long for high inflation to take hold.
Well, I'm not sure that high inflation has taken hold, and I'm not sure it's going to be persistent and sustained. What we have right now is prices going up, and it's a very healthy sign that the Fed, in particular, the chairman, has had to change the party line. So instead of reassuring words, patting us on the head and saying, no, this is just temporary, they're facing the reality that it could well become sustained, and that's good because they're changing course towards less inflationary policies.
So what they're saying is good.
Yeah.
The inflation itself
doing
is not
is,
good.
Right. Yes, and what they're doing is good, and I think I hope interest rates go up, not just to fight inflation because it's good for savers. What we've had is a system where wild, crazy spenders are very much in the saddle in terms of where the most attractive investments are. And it's good when people who save as opposed to spend have good income. With interest rates so nominal, near zero, it's been hard for savers, old folks like me. For instance, who need reliable income.
Right.
Is that clear? If it's not, it's my fault if it's not clear.
No, most of it is clear. I'm not sure I yet understand, however, what all of this spending that you talked about, all this putting so much money into the system, I'm not sure I understand the mechanism by which then that makes my Rice Krispies so much more expensive than they used to be. I mean, what does a lot of money have to do with prices rising? Why does that make prices rise?
The federal government has been sending out a lot of money into the system. The federal relief programs, which are unprecedented during the pandemic, grants are available, money's available, loans are available at very low interest rates for businesses and people. The Fed has been sending a lot of money into the system. They've been buying equities as well as bonds of all kinds, sending money into the system. So when you have a lot of money sloshing around, that means that there's a lot more bidding for services, whether it's workers' labor or your Rice Krispies or an apartment to rent or a house to buy. So that means prices tend to go up. Is that clear?
Yeah.
So I'm not a technical economist, but it is important, if I'm going to do my job right, to be clear. Is what I just said clear?
I think so, yeah.
You said you think so. What is not clear? A lot of money.
Well, I'm less than an economist than you are, so
no,
I'm just talking about
a lot of money in the hands of people, so they're spending, which is the reason for those policies, and that means they're bidding up the prices of goods.
So in other words, so-and-so can afford to price whatever they're selling higher because there's more money out there and people
very
can afford.
Very clearly put, yes, demand is up. Okay. So also that leads to the factors that go into prices going up. Commodities are going up in price.
Right. Okay.
And interest rates are very low, so you can borrow a lot of money. You don't have to rely on whatever real income you have. You can borrow money and spend. If that goes on indefinitely, eventually there's going to be a terrible crash.
Right.
I honestly thought, given our initial fear reaction to the pandemic collectively, I thought that there would be a serious recession last year. And as usual in the real world, with me, I was wrong. Sure as hell glad I was wrong about that.
Right. I'm just curious, the numbers that they're talking about in terms of our current inflation, they were saying that inflation is as high as it was back in the days of Ronald Reagan. I'm just, I mean, we were both around during Ronald Reagan. Do you happen to recall what was going on that made inflation so high at that point in time?
Was that was the tag end of an inflation that was really devastating throughout the 1970s. Hmm. The Johnson administration engaged in, for the time, unprecedented deficits because the Vietnam War surprised the president and Defense Secretary McNamara and others, as wars often do. And it blew the lid off of the federal budget because what they hoped would be a manageable war. Beware the man who says this war is going to be manageable anytime, any country, anywhere. Plus the president's very ambitious domestic spending programs, the so-called Great Society. Richard Nixon, Johnson's successor, put tremendous and, I believe, irresponsible pressure on poor old Arthur Burns, the hapless head of the Fed, to be extremely liberal with monetary policy, despite the fact that inflation was already going strong. Jimmy Carter, who deserves a lot more credit than he gets, in my opinion, in several policy areas, engaged in some fiscal discipline for a change, which contributed to his election loss to Reagan in 80, but he nominated Paul Volcker to be head of the Fed. Mm. And Volcker jacked up interest rates and restrained money supply in a way that broke the back of inflation. So it was already going down,
right?
But not early enough or fast enough to permit Carter to be reelected. There are various factors, including Reagan's tremendous magnetism and shrewdness as a politician. But the timing was right because things were improving, but we still had very high unemployment and high inflation combined. Is that clear?
Yeah, good. Perfectly.
I'm making progress.
Yeah.
Thank you, student.
Well, I'm making progress.
We're both making progress together, young man.
It's interesting. I can remember, oddly enough, the inflation of the early 1970s, even though I was just, you know, maybe 12 years old. But I can remember literally going into the grocery store and not buying Rice Krispies. I can remember buying Cocoa Krispies off the shelf, and I can remember a pile of stickers of price tags on that box of cereal because one day it was such and such, and then a couple days later it would go up in price, and they would just slap another price tag on that same box of cereal. Of course, that's way before the days of barcodes and so on. So you had the price stamped on what you were buying, and so there might be like 8 or 9 price tags on that price of cereal, which represented in a very graphic way how the price of that box of cereal was skyrocketing over the course of just maybe a week or two. I mean, for a 12-year-old, I mean, who didn't know anything about anything, I still remember what that looked like and remember thinking something's wrong here.
Yeah, and it generates fear, as you just quite effectively indicated, which is extraordinarily destructive for the system. One important factor, which I didn't mention, was OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. They jacked up oil prices very ruthlessly and dramatically in 73, and then they did it again in 79. And that was a rather unique time, apparently, in the international oil market. But they were able to make a lot of money, which most of them didn't seem to invest very well, these producing countries, which includes Venezuela as well as Arab states. And they have not been able to do it since. Believe me, they would love to. Earlier in 1960, they tried an embargo. We were still an oil exporter. By the 70s, we'd become a major importer. The good news, and it's always important to mention good news in our current media environment, is that we have returned to the position since around the turn of the century, a vast exporter in petroleum and also finished gasoline products. So once again, the United States is an enormously powerful producer. And that's one reason why I don't think the current inflation will turn into a 1970s stagflation. My family and I moved to Chicago in 76 to take a job at the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. And I'm very glad I did. Led to being on your program, among other good things. But wages and prices are principal factors for any, and food, given our program, for any nonprofit, and we struggled. Mm. We never had a deficit. In nonprofit work, a deficit will kill you. Mm. That is death. Mm. And in these prosperous times, it's important to reiterate that point. We never had a deficit. We managed to keep growing in real terms. But I tell you, we were working like hell at that time
right,
to survive and stay independent.
Yeah, in tough
always
times.
Always tough. Well, also, Chicago's a tough right. environment.
Yeah.
It really is.
I remember the term stagflation, and I never took the time to really investigate it. So I guess that's when inflation takes hold and doesn't loosen its grip.
Exactly.
So
it becomes self-reinforcing.
Interesting.
And
okay.
the example always pointed to, quite rightly, is Germany in the 20s, where you can see old newsreels of German people with literally wheels, with wheelbarrows full of Deutschmarks because their currency had become worthless. And that was a prime factor in the rise of the Nazis and the election of the Nazi Party and Hitler becoming chancellor.
Scary stuff.
It is, but that's not going to. That hasn't happened here, and I'm confident it's not going to.
Right.
And it's not going to happen again in Germany.
Right. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking today with Dr. Art Sear. Speaking of Germany, I know one of the things I wanted to be sure to talk with you about was something that you only very briefly mention in one of your recent columns, and that is the, I think, still impending retirement, or has she in fact retired?
She has stepped down. You're very timely. She just...
Okay.
Angela Merkel just
right.
stepped down after a long tenure, since starting in 2005.
She is someone that you have obviously great admiration and respect for. You've mentioned that on many, many occasions on your visits to this program. What is it about her as a leader that has been so significant and impressive for you, and what kind of difference has she made for the nation of Germany during this time of her leadership?
She's obviously a very durable leader and provided stability, which is important in any country, but especially with our German friends, it's fair to say. She's a very effective executive. She's an honest person. She is someone who has pursued successful policies. Germany is the largest and most important economy on the continent, and she has pursued a middle way of effective policies that nonetheless, along with her other skills, have not brought her down. She has been very disciplined in the context of the EU in making sure there are reins around controls on more free spending countries, Latin Europe to the south. That has helped her survive. She's also been very liberal in welcoming refugees. And that really bothers and in certain circles enrages highly nationalistic Germans, not just older people, who feel, who are given to feeling like the victims of history and the victims of geography. She's just been very, very skillful, I think, combining humanitarianism with economic discipline and avoiding extremism. She,
right.
Her rather steady, stalwart, calm, maternal image, I think, has been ideal for Germany at this time. It's what I think.
Mm. In other words, just to look at her and to hear her speak, there's nothing particularly glamorous about her.
That's good.
Well, but as you say, that's worked. It's in a sense exactly what that nation needed at that point in time, and especially dealing with some kind of vexing issues or issues that are complicated.
Yes, the Germans tend to go in for very colorful politicians. Including, but obviously, but going well beyond the Third Reich, and there seems to be a kind of attraction to highly articulate, very dramatic, charismatic leaders. Helmut Schmidt, a very successful social democrat from the last decades of the 20th century, a kind of arrogance, a kind of abrasiveness. A willingness to be very critical of the U.S. That seems to be, not surprisingly, very congenial to their culture. And she has been a calming influence in that context. She's a protege of Helmut Kohl, who was tripped up at the end with political scandal and other things that I don't think he was directly involved in. But... he was contrary to type, a very bland, avuncular leader. He did not speak English, which is unusual for German
political leaders post-war. He really helped stabilize Germany immediately after the end of the Cold War. I got to know Germany in practical terms because John Reilly, the longtime president of the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, he was there for 30 years, which is quite extraordinary. Quite a good entrepreneur, and very effective. He was really connected in Germany and knew Helmut Kohl. We received a large endowment grant of $3 million thanks to John's long-term efforts. It provided us with a great expansion of our endowment. We avoided a layoff, which was impending and which we never had during our tenure. Kohl was often compared to an American machine politician. He really knew the party structure of the CDU and partner CSU. He was a great behind-the-scenes operator. And he deserves a lot of credit for stabilizing Germany, contrary to type, like I say, avoiding temptations toward extremism. And he really brought us Angela Merkel. So he's somebody worth mentioning.
Yeah, very good.
No, he didn't seem German. Thanks to John, I had the chance to meet him a couple of times. Much more like a very pragmatic American politician.
Interesting. Do we know who is Angela Merkel's successor, and do we have any sense of what's ahead?
It's a coalition government, a man by the name of Scholz, who is not particularly well-defined, from the Social Democratic Party, a coalition that involves the Greens, the Environmental Party, which is quite powerful in Germany and steadily more so, and the Free Democrats, which is a liberal free market party of the sort that are in every European country, but generally aren't in government, except for the Liberal Democrats in Britain for about 5 years from 2010 with a conservative coalition. It's good because there's party alternation in Germany, and we'll see what happens. She's going to be a very hard act to follow.
No kidding. For sure. You mentioned Angela Merkel in a column from a couple of weeks ago, talking about the tense situation right now between Russia and Ukraine, with the specter of Russian military buildup on the border of Ukraine, which sure looks like it could possibly mean Russia, you know, kind of taking aim at Ukraine once again. You mentioned in the course of this column peace accord that had been hammered out, and in which Angela Merkel, among others, had a very important hand. And one of the things you say in your column is that although maybe the United States should be concerned, that this is primarily a European matter, and you really call on the Europeans to take the lead in sort of navigating this current situation. Am I remembering
that
right?
Yes. Well, that's their backyard. Europeans should be taking as much initiative as possible in diplomacy and strategy related to Europe. I wrote the column in the context of the President Biden, President Putin dramatic Zoom meeting, I guess. telephonic but direct conversation.
Right.
It's fine to be in touch, especially since the Cold War, in direct terms, but the real day-to-day diplomacy should be handled by the Europeans. And we Americans tend to want to do it ourselves.
Right.
And the more I mentioned George Kennan, K-E-N-N-A-N.
Yes.
If you really want to learn about U.S. foreign policy, especially regarding Europe, and what the Europeans should be doing, anything he's written, including his memoirs, are worthwhile.
Right. I want to read from that in a second. But first, I want to read this. You write, the United States should be involved and supportive, but dominating negotiations encourages Europeans to avoid hard strategic leadership.
Yes.
And spend time on their preferred relatively easy tasks of building Euro bureaucracy and talking amongst themselves.
Yes, more rules and regulations, especially against those hated American tech companies, which is one reason why our economy does so well. We're not nearly so into trust busting and forms to fill out and rules and regulations for the spiritual sons, the successors to Steve Jobs.
Right. And so I guess what you're saying is if when the United States yields to the temptation of being too involved, too hands-on in a matter involving Russia and Ukraine and Europe, that gets them, that is the Europeans, kind of off the hook.
Exactly. Right. We should be spending our time in the Middle East, where an American leadership role is vital, where we, in fact, were the leaders of the region during the George H.W. Bush administration in the wake of the enormously important and successful Gulf War to remove Iraq's troops from Kuwait, a comprehensive international coalition. Bush and James Baker, as Secretary of State, followed that up with brilliant, exhausting diplomacy. And we actually had relative stability in the Mideast. We frittered that away, starting with Clinton.
Right.
A couple of sporadic successes, I have to admit, under Donald Trump in terms of new states recognizing Israel. But the Russians are in charge in the Middle East.
Mm.
Well, you know, we spend our time, unfortunately, allocated elsewhere.
Mm.
At the top.
Right. I wanted to also mention, you do indeed quote American diplomat George Kennan, and in particular something he wrote back in 1954, and you tell us that that George Kennan focused on prudent realist diplomacy, which assumes conflict in national interests is inevitable. In other words, you shouldn't go into negotiations with kind of rosy expectations. You should understand that you have different countries, different cultures. There is going to be conflict. There's going to be maybe very sharp differences. And you need to understand that and to some extent accept that. And that's the pathway towards hammering out something meaningful.
Yes.
You just understand that we're not all the same. Just because we're all earthlings doesn't mean we see the world differently or operate in the same way.
George Kennan was extraordinarily influential at a crucial time as World War II was ending and just ended, and the Cold War was inevitably emerging. He came up with the concept and approach of containment as the best way to deal with the Soviet Union, a country and culture fundamentally different from ourselves, which is the point he made especially in that 1954 book you cited.
So containment versus changing. I mean, like trying to change the Soviet Union into something else, or God forbid, eliminate them. I mean, containing them was he felt the wise way to go.
Yes, because the communist system will collapse thanks to its internal contradictions and the basic unworkability of communism, especially as implemented in Russia and the Soviet Union. And he turned out to be right.
Hmm.
It's always good when you're actually right. and he was emphasizing an approach that was traditional diplomacy at a time when there was a body of opinion in the U.S. that we should be collaborating with Joseph Stalin as much as possible, and we should be accommodating the Soviet Union as much as possible. Roosevelt's vice president in his third term, Henry Wallace, was in effect a fellow traveler of the Soviet Union. He was in regular contact with Stalin. He challenged Harry Truman. He became Secretary of Commerce under the Truman administration. Truman quite rightly fired him. He was trying to pursue his own foreign policy. He ran as a third-party candidate in 1948. And statements were carefully coordinated with the Soviet Union. Communism is so totally dead in this country today that it's easy to overlook the fact that we did have communists in our government, including a gentleman by the name of Alger Hiss, who was a top State Department official, not just one or two, but a number of scientists in the Manhattan Project were sympathetic to communism. It was a very different culture. At the other extreme, we had preemptive war. We should be liberating Eastern Europe, which was part of the Republican Party platform in 1952. Eisenhower, subtle as always, had a conference as soon as the Republicans finally came back to power in 1952, the Solarium Conference in 1953, where George Kennan was brought back from where he'd been, in effect, exiled by the Republicans. Containment as opposed to preemptive war, which was a real possibility, or isolationism, which had strong support in the Republican Party, containment continued to be American foreign policy even after the Republicans came back. Eisenhower had a Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, who was temperamentally extremely hostile to containment, wanted to take a much more aggressive approach. I'm going on at length, as I often do, but it was a very, very complicated time and very different from today. It really was a very different environment from today, and you really have to understand that to understand why George Kennan remains so important.
Mm-hmm. I know at the end of this column you suggest that readers curious to learn more or know more should investigate his memoirs.
Yes, indeed. He's a very fine writer. He had a mixed record as diplomat. He was a very unsuccessful ambassador to the Soviet Union, thanks to his great bluntness, and was fired almost immediately in the Truman administration. President Kennedy quite wisely brought him back, rehabilitated him, and made him ambassador to Yugoslavia, where the Tito government was already quite independent from Moscow. And Kennan was a pretty good ambassador then. Mm-hmm. He was much more thinker and analyst, though, than gifted diplomat.
Interesting. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Art Sear, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, and a monthly visitor to the morning show. You also wrote a recent column I found very interesting about the nation of Colombia, in part on a personal note, because my younger brother Steve and his partner have just purchased a small home in Colombia. And they are very, very excited. But, you know, it made me realize I don't really know a whole lot about Colombia, but I sure hope it's not like Venezuela, which he assured me it's not, that it's a much more stable nation and beautiful and with a lot to offer and so on. But anyway, so
In Bogota?
Yeah, or close to it, yeah. But anyway, so my eyes kind of lit up when your recent column was about Colombia, and in particular about an announcement from the Biden administration late November regarding a group called FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, and in a sense kind of a downgrading of their sort of threat level as a terrorist organization. Tell us more about that announcement on November 23rd and, in a sense, why it's good news, whether or not one lives in Bogota or not.
Yeah, for many years it appeared that there was going to be a communist takeover, even after the Cold War in Colombia. FARC is an acronym of the Spanish version of the title you just mentioned for the Revolutionary Armed Forces. They were a criminal gang, a drug cartel, an extraordinarily heavily armed, effective, and lethal mafia that controlled a lot of territory in Colombia. As I understand the evolution, they embraced communism after they were already in existence, and for some years, around the turn of the century and afterwards, it seemed like Vietnam all over again. We were sending more and more advisors, including law enforcement, as well as military in and out of uniform, more and more small weapons, more and more helicopter gunships. And President George W. Bush, very much to my mind, like President Kennedy and President Johnson before 1965, were trying to really keep this out of the headlines. We became more and more involved. And then the insurgency began to fade with the Kennedy people and, for a time, the Johnson people, till reality overcame them. We're hoping for that the insurgency would be defeated. It simply faded in Colombia. The British were very successful generally in handling insurgencies. I believe they're the one colonial power that never experienced the kind of quagmire that engulfed us, as well as the French in Indochina, and for the French in Algeria and elsewhere, the Portuguese in Angola. They were able to defeat completely a communist insurgency in Malaya, not far from Vietnam. They had advantages that the Colombian government didn't have regarding the FARC, but it is a case of an insurgency being defeated and ultimately absorbed into the central government. It's quite remarkable. And FARC leaders, they were really into kidnapping for many years.
which used to be quite popular in Latin America, especially corporate executives who were held for ransom. It still goes on in Brazil and Venezuela. All of that seems to have faded in Colombia, so it probably is indeed a good place to buy a house.
Wow.
And they've been taken off the U.S. terrorist list, which is what prompted the column.
So in other words, they do not pose anything close to the threat that they once did.
That's right. Wow. That's right.
And as you very rightly point out, good news can easily get lost in this current media environment. You also remind us that even when serious journalism was in its heyday, that was still the case. We still have a tendency to gravitate towards bad news rather than
good.
Oh,
sure. Yeah, Richard Nixon had a now notorious vice president, Spiro Agnew, who was finally forced to resign because of corruption, and part of his job, he was referred to as Nixon's Nixon. He would go around and beat up on the press, as Nixon did, as senator and congressman and Ike's vice president. And Agnew would regularly say, why don't you people, in his heavy-handed, unsmiling way, why don't you people emphasize good news? I'd like to see good news in headlines. So I have written about him as Spiro, quote, good news, unquote, Agnew.
Right. Yeah, not exactly a bright, sunny personality, but calling for a little more good news.
It's always been that way. But today, with pervasive media and a change in the culture of journalism, it is worse.
Yeah, I agree. We're going to finish out today by talking about two significant Americans who recently passed away. And this is a column that you shared with me, but I think, I don't know when most people are likely to see it, maybe tomorrow or so. Is that when it'll appear in print?
It depends. It'll be in the Kenosha News, speaking locally, on Friday.
This coming Friday.
Yeah,
okay.
And other papers. I'll be sending it out, if not today, tomorrow.
Okay.
And midweek, it'll be popping up online.
Okay. So so this is a sort of a little peek preview of this latest column, in which you talk about two important Americans who recently died. Very recently, Bob Dole, and then a few weeks before that, Colin Powell. And one of the things you talk about is that they are a very interesting sort of study in similarities and contrasts, that there are similarities between the two of these two men and also very, very striking differences. But one thing that they really hold in common is their long-term, tenacious commitment to public service.
Yes, indeed. Both very durable public leaders, and folks, you heard it first on the morning show with Greg Berg.
Right. Let's talk first about Bob Dole. I really appreciated the length to which he went in kind of reminding us about his personal story. I mean, it's a story I think a lot of us maybe had heard something about, particularly years ago when he was a candidate for vice president and so on. But I had frankly forgotten so much of his story about, first of all, his early life in Russell, Kansas, and the promise that life held out for him, and then what sort of engulfed him as a soldier. Remind our listeners about kind of the backstory of Bob Dole.
Well, he seemed to personify rural America in terms of, he was referred to, including by himself, as a son of Kansas. Mm. His farm family was overcome by the Great Depression. And then at that time, we had climate problems that were quite devastating to the heartland, what seemed like endless drought and dust storms in the 30s. So his parents, who were already struggling, ended up having to rent out their farmhouse, and they lived in the basement. Mm. In this small town during really, really hard times. He never lost his determination. He was a very talented young man. He was voted best looking by his high school class in Russell, Kansas. He was a triple threat man, at least. He lettered in football, basketball, and I think track. Was planning to go to college and be a surgeon. He did go to college and took ROTC and then was swept up by another great challenge, the Second World War. He volunteered for the 10th Mountain Division, which is an elite, specially focused on mountain warfare army unit. I think the 10th Mountain Division still exists. In any case, in heavy combat in Italy in in the war. He was a lieutenant who went to save one of his men who was wounded, exposed himself to German fire, and was literally a large part of his body shattered by steel fragments, I think from a shell. He came back home in a body cast and spent more than 3 years in surgery, which he survived, and he did not become a surgeon, his initial ambition, but he did go into politics with great success. It did seem to engender a kind of bitterness in him, and he was known, especially when he was younger, as very much a hatchet man, referring to Nixon, of the Republican Party. He was picked as vice presidential nominee by Gerald Ford, a kind of odd choice, to my mind, in 1976.
The two of them are certainly an odd pairing, that's for sure.
Yes, well, they're also both from the Midwest, and the conventional wisdom is you should pick different geographic regions, which I believe still makes sense in both parties. Anyway, Ford just barely lost to Jimmy Carter, and one factor was Bob Dole's extremely ugly performance in the vice presidential debate with Walter Mondale, a naturally upbeat politician, protege of Hubert Humphrey, who happens to be a great hero of mine from the time I was a kid. And Mondale handled it extremely well, but Dole started referring to Democrat wars. We count up all the corpses, all the bodies of men who've been killed in Democrat wars. Later on, he did develop a better sense of humor with age, something we should all aspire to. And Bob Dole would say with a laugh, a kind of hollow laugh, but he would say, "I really went for the jugular that time, my own." He became more and more, speaking of Humphrey and Everett Dirksen and other major legislators, he beat Lyndon Johnson in the Senate. He became extraordinarily effective at getting things done in the Senate.
Yeah, I remember in the column
you
say he was...
Excuse me.
He became more of a pragmatist over time.
Yes, and less a kind of Midwest hardcore conservative from farm country.
Right.
He got the presidential nomination in 1996. Like a lot of politicians, he wasn't well organized. I had a certain vantage point in my job in Chicago, especially before Super Tuesday, we would get presidential candidates because Illinois was quite pivotal, so I became something of a self-appointed expert. The Dole campaign in 96 was incredibly disorganized, in great contrast to the Clinton efforts. We did have him at the council, and I'm grateful and proud we did, but you could see why he lost. He was a legislative genius, quite practiced. He was not a good presidential candidate. He had tried in 80 and 88 and lost, but he sure as hell was durable.
Right.
And it was a nice compliment to him and his good qualities that he got the nomination. But Clinton won without any difficulty.
Right. The closest I ever came to encountering him directly was that his wife, Barbara Dole, came to the WGTD studios during that presidential campaign.
Ah, what was it like?
She was great. She was sparkling and crisp and efficient and outgoing, and she was very, very effective. I didn't actually get to interview her. My friend Bill Guy did, but I stood out in the hall and got to listen through the door, and her handlers kept shushing us as we quietly talked in the hallway. I mean, they were, but it was great to meet her, and she worked hard. But it was all for naught, of course. But yeah, she was very impressive.
Well, they were the quintessential Washington power couple. She had cabinet office, and Elizabeth Dole did run for president, but unsuccessfully. It's a rather touching picture of her with kneeling with her head on his casket, which is readily available.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, quite a nice compliment to him. She had traditional gracious virtues.
Right. Yeah. Some of the gifts that he possessed in lesser amounts.
Yeah. Bob was damn lucky, I often thought, in that regard.
Right. Let's also talk about Colin Powell. And, of course, he's also a very striking figure, in some ways dramatically different from Bob Dole, but no less committed to service of our country, and ultimately someone who rose to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and also Secretary of State among other significant positions that he held in the United States. You tell us that that his tenure as Secretary of State was not nearly so successful or happy for him as some of the other positions that he took.
Yes, we had a very powerful, a different kind of couple, a professional couple, Vice President Cheney and Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld, who after being the youngest Secretary of Defense in the Ford administration, was the oldest in the George W. Bush administration. Powell preferred a much more diplomatic course toward Russia, China, and other countries. And Rumsfeld was never associated with being modest or reticent. He'd be the first to admit that. And he kept intervening publicly in Powell's turf. There's always a lot of infighting in Washington at the top. But in this case, I think the second Bush was remarkably inept in controlling his own administration. And after being, in effect, sidelined repeatedly and at times embarrassed by saying publicly things that were quite different from what the carefully coordinated Cheney and Rumsfeld were saying, he didn't resign, which could have been disastrous for Bush politically, but he did serve only one term, and it was not a happy time for him.
Right. Let's talk about what made him such a sterling success story in other respects, if aside from the struggles he had as Secretary of State. What do you think is most admirable about who Colin Powell was and how he conducted himself?
Dedication to public service and, to my mind, like Barack Obama, with a different style and a different career path. He provided a very fine personal example for all of us, but including young African-American males especially, commitment to public service, commitment to professional integrity, as well as success. There was a movement in the 1990s, to a genuine grassroots movement to get him to pursue and secure the Republican presidential nomination. And in my rare free time at the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, I participated in that. It was very similar to the sentiment around Eisenhower in the early 50s. And there were older business people, especially older men from banking and finance in the Northeast, who as very young people had been part of that Eisenhower movement in the late 40s, early 50s. It was quite fascinating to me. We did get him at the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations when he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. You can always tell a lot about a leader by the staff that a man or woman has, especially in politics. And like with Ike, Colin Powell's staff really loved the guy. Not because he was warm and fuzzy, but because he was very able, very smart. He always got big jobs done, and he was a genuinely decent man.
Right, with very, very high integrity. It's really interesting to think about what
might
have happened.
Quite a presence to be around, yeah.
Yeah, right.
And a real gentleman and quick, which by all accounts that was a characteristic of Ike's. He was very, very quick in handling situations, people.
Yeah, interesting to think about what a presidency of Colin Powell would have looked like.
Well, he really, you know, it would have broken up the current party dynamics. An awful lot of African Americans would have voted for Colin Powell, and it could have renewed the Republican Party, and in my biased opinion, taken them in a much more healthy direction than they've been going in with Trump and associates.
Fascinating.
It is fascinating, yeah.
Well, but on that note, I'm afraid the time is gone. It has evaporated as rapidly as it always does, but just means we have more to talk about when you join us, I hope, in the month of January for more conversation.
Well, Greg, they just have to give you a longer program.
There you go.
Especially when I am on.
That's right. Yes. The simplest solution are the best solutions. So, well, until we've pursued that, we'll look forward to another hour with you in the months to come. Dr. Art Seer-Clausen, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College. I deeply appreciate each and every one of these conversations. I thank you for all of them and look forward to more conversations in the months and years to come. And thanks for being part of the morning show today.
Well, thank you, Greg, and Merry Christmas, NPR.